Kia ora, and welcome to Amran's Podcast, episode 184. Today is Monday, November 2nd, 2009. I don't normally record on a Monday, but I have two reasons for doing so today. The first is that I'm just going to be too busy tomorrow. But the second and main reason is that November 2nd is my expat-iversary, or the anniversary of the date that I became an expat. On November 2nd, 1995, my United Airlines flight touched down in Auckland, and I began my life in this country. Because of that, it means that Nigel and I have always considered this to be our anniversary, because this was the date our life together began. Over the course of this podcast, over its nearly 3 years, I've talked about the process that I went through, some of the things I've experienced, some of my impressions, and I've just sort of shared bits and pieces about New Zealand, and all of that stuff is things I'm going to continue to do in the future. But today I thought I might hit on some of my main lessons that I've learned over those 14 years. And one of the things that I've always advised people who are considering being an expat is to read the history of the place they want to move. And there's two reasons for that. First, it helps to have a sound intellectual grounding relative to the place you're going to move to understand how things came to be the way they are. Also, it helps give you a sort of a cultural understanding before you get there, because anyone who's born there will have grown up through the school system. They will have learned at least the highlights of the country's history. And by studying it yourself, you prepare yourself to be able to at least know what they're talking about. And that can also include brief references to something historical on a TV show or in a movie or in a song or whatever. It helps you understand what's going on as well. And when I say study history, I'm not just talking about learning the big things, like, say, that the Treaty of Waitangi was signed in 1840, for instance, but also some of the smaller stories, the things that led to the bigger stories, or maybe they're small stories. And there are all kinds, for any country, pretty much, you can find these sorts of histories out there. New Zealand is blessed in having quite a lot of really good histories written. One of the most accessible general histories for New Zealand is Michael King's Penguin History of New Zealand, which was an award winner. Unfortunately, he died not long after it was published. But it is an excellent general history of the country. And he also wrote a lot of smaller histories as well, and plenty of others have as well. And so it's a good place to start. But the most important thing for anybody considering moving to another country is to visit it. Now, I know that sounds obvious, and you would think, well, of course, you've already visited it before you decide to live there. But it is surprising how many people decide or think that they've decided that they're going to move to a place, they even might start the process before they've even actually visited it. And quite frankly, that's just dumb. Unless you visit a place, you can't possibly know if it's a place you'd want to live. I mean, most people within their own countries wouldn't consider just packing up and moving to another town sight unseen. They at least want to have visited it first. Well, the stakes are much higher if you're moving, especially as I did, to the other side of the planet. So it's really important that you go check it out first. Now, I had a very brief time here when I came to visit it, but it was enough. I'd already started studying New Zealand history. I picked up the pace once I arrived here. And so, I mean, I practice what I preach. Although, if I had it to do over again, I might have read a bit more history before I came to New Zealand, so I, you know, had this sort of a grounding. But nevertheless, I still did read history as one of my priorities. The main thing to know about becoming an expat is that the longer you're away from your homeland, the more that homeland will begin to seem like a foreign country to you. Now, this took me by some surprise, I have to say, because I just sort of thought, you know, it just sort of goes on and things don't change. Well, of course they change. People change, they move on, some people die. They just drift out of your life in some cases. All kinds of different things happen. And change can be massive, especially the longer you're away from a place. When I left the United States and moved to New Zealand, internet was still in its infancy, at least as we would understand the term today. The access to internet was expensive and it was very slow. There basically was no World Wide Web. It was just starting out. There certainly were no personal websites. There were no blogs, no podcasts, nothing like that. So it was a very different realm, you could say, in the world. And that obviously has changed a lot over those 14 years, and a lot of other things have as well, some great, some awful, some in between. But the point really isn't whether the change that's happened in the U.S. since I've been away has been good, bad, or indifferent. What matters is that it's been big change, so much so that I wouldn't even recognize the place anymore in many cases. And it wasn't something that I ever thought about in advance. It never occurred to me that that kind of thing would happen, although it's obvious if I really had stopped to think about it, how much things would change. But I didn't think about it. So for many years, when people would ask me the question, do you think you'd ever move back to the U.S.? I always kind of hedged my answer and tried to avoid it. And the part of the reason was because I didn't know how to answer it, because I didn't want to make it seem like I hated it here, because I don't, didn't. And I also didn't want to make it seem like I hated my homeland, because I don't and I didn't. So I never really knew how to answer it. But I have since come to realize, and this is actually pretty recent, that the chances of me ever going back to live in the U.S. are pretty slim, slim to none even. And it's primarily because of this change that's happened. Now, the longer I'm away, the greater the change becomes, as I said. So if I'm here, say, another 14 years, that means it'll be 3 decades since I left. Nothing will be the same anymore. And it just is not. It would mean being like an immigrant all over again. And I don't think I'd want to do that at that stage of my life. But I also have often said that one can never know what the future holds. And so it's best to try to never say never, as they say. Because if you had said to me 15 years ago that in a year's time I'd be packing up and moving to New Zealand, I would have told you you were crazy. So you should never worry too much about the nevers of the world. But that actually leads me into a kind of a related topic, and that's about Nigel and me. When we first met and all that, it was there were a lot of things that we had to overcome. The fact that I had to get the permission to stay in New Zealand and work here, and then eventually to get permanent residence and eventually citizenship. All of this took time, it took effort, and there was impermanence to our lives right up until I got citizenship. Until then, theoretically, I could have been told to leave at any time. Well, since then, too, of course, New Zealand has enacted the Civil Union Act, and that gave us our second anniversary, because on January 24th, we entered our civil union, and now our relationship is legally recognized as well. So these sorts of things added permanence to my life over these past 14 years, and they've sort of come along at a relatively steady pace, actually. And as that permanence here has grown, it's been at the same time that the changes in America have been increasing the gap between what I experience and what America is, which sort of kind of, for lack of a better term, sort of pushes me more in the New Zealand column as time has gone on. And I would suspect that other expats have had similar experiences where they find themselves almost drawn into their new homeland over time, which is not to say that they ever in any way abandon their old homeland. It's just that it's kind of like being carried out by a rip. I think Americans usually call it a rip tide. But anyway, being carried out to sea in a rip, you can't fight it. You just have to kind of go with it, and then it takes you where it takes you. And hope that the lifeguards get you in time. No, seriously. It's essentially what it's like, because there are almost like life forces that are at work that you really have very little control over. And you can either fight it, which is wasted energy, or you can just kind of go along with it and see where it leads. And I actually think that having a sense of adventure, a sense of, let's see where this goes, or a sense of discovery, if you prefer, is a vital attribute for someone to be a happy expat. And what I mean by that is that you've got to be willing to sort of let things happen, to not go to a place and think to yourself, it's going to be this way, this way, this way, this way, but rather, I wonder what this is going to be like, and just experience it. The thing is that if I had moved across the U.S., I would have done essentially the same thing. I would have tried not to have had preconceived notions of how things would be, and I would have just kind of gone with the flow and, seen where things led. Well, I would use the same advice for somebody moving to another country. Try not to expect really anything. Just try to let experiences happen, and also look for experiences. where you can find them, things that allow you to experience different aspects of life in the new country. This sense of discovery or adventure, whatever you want to call it, I think is a vital attribute for somebody who's going to be successful moving anywhere where they've never lived before. Excuse me, whether it's across the country or across the world doesn't really matter as far as that goes. It's the wanting to find out more and understand more. It's a really good, positive, and helpful attribute to have for anybody who moves far away from their home. But with Nigel and me, of course, we share this sort of sense of adventure or discovery or whatever, and that's been really good. And that's obviously helped us over the past 14 years. But one of the biggest lessons I've learned, and this has less to do with being an expat than just in general, is a simple one. And it is that 15 years ago, if somebody had told me that I'd be living on the other side of the world in New Zealand, I would have told them they were crazy. So what that tells me is that no one should ever assume that their dreams won't come true, because you never know. One day, you might just be one day away from it all starting. I couldn't have known 14 years ago that things were going to turn out so wonderfully, both living in New Zealand and also, of course, being with Nigel. But they did. And I had some tools and maybe some attributes that helped me along the way, and that's what I've been trying to share today, and actually throughout the course of the podcast and my blog too, for that matter. Hopefully, somebody somewhere has found something useful in all that. I get emails from people from time to time that suggest that they do find things interesting, and that's good. It's wonderful. It's heartening. And I know that there are other people I'll never hear from who hopefully have gotten something useful out of these bits and pieces as well. That's why I continue to do it. And it's also why there's the airplane sound at the beginning of every one of these normal podcasts, not the live ones because it's too loud, but the normal podcasts. It's a reminder of the fact that I came to this land from somewhere else, that although I am a New Zealander, I'm also from somewhere else, that I'm also of another land. And that's why I still use it to this day, and why I expect I'll continue to use it even as I, you know, from time to time change the opening. So those are some thoughts and reflections on my 14th anniversary in New Zealand, and Nigel and my 14th anniversary together, or one of our anniversaries together. Now, today I have a few other things that I'm going to go over as well, including comments. But one of the first things I wanted to talk about was about a study that was released in Britain that found that in that country, those who illegally download music from the internet also spend more money on music than anyone else, according to a new study. That's the opening paragraph. And essentially what it found was that among people who admitted to illegally downloading music, they spent more than twice as much on music as people who said that they never download music illegally. Now, the context of this is that the British government is looking at a change to their law similar to the copyright amendment that was defeated here in New Zealand, giving it three strikes and you're out for internet connections. You know, they disconnect you after three goes. So it's interesting that they have now found evidence that the illegal downloaders are not the great demons that they're always made out to be by the music industry, which is, of course, a position I've taken all along. And also the fact that, as far as I'm concerned, the music and film and television industries have no one to blame but themselves for illegal downloads, because they make it so difficult to get their product. It's got to do with international licensing, zoning of DVDs, all of these sorts of things all play into it. It took us years to get iTunes here in New Zealand. When we finally did, people started buying music from it. Surprise, surprise, surprise. And they rent movies and buy movies from iTunes, but it's still quite slow, obviously, because of the different release schedules that movies still have and still maintain. There are very few, well, I should say there are very few, there aren't, not all movies are on worldwide release at the same time. Part of it is they still think that they have to try to coincide with the local seasons and things, which is stupid, because if they do that, that means it's just going to create demand for illegal downloads. Same is true with television. Things like Hulu are not available outside the U.S., and that's dumb, because that just drives people to the illegal market. All they need to do is to open it up, and the market will come. To create the market, and the people will come. iTunes has proven that. All they have to do is now just follow through on it. And it's so bloody obvious. You'd think that they would get it, but they just don't seem to. So I don't know if this study is going to help at all. I, through a roundabout way, through a link on Twitter, I went to the website of Kurt Smith, who was half of Tears for Fears back in the 80s. And he releases his music under Creative Commons licensing. Essentially, he retains all of the commercial rights to his music, but he licenses it for people to remix and to reuse and include in any non-commercial thing. And commercial means something you make money off of. Doesn't mean you have to be a company. It just means you're selling it, whatever it is. If you're going to sell it, you've got to get his permission and work out a licensing deal. But if you're not for profit, if you're not making a profit on it, like, say, a podcaster, then you can use it. And I think that that is the a perfect way to go. The big labels hate the idea of Creative Commons because they think that they're not going to be able to control money anymore. But Kurt Smith's approach shows that you can still control all of the money-making opportunities while still opening up creativity and creating more awareness of your music, in this case, or whatever else it might be, by licensing people to use your creative product in certain ways. So you add that together with the fact that we've already seen ample evidence that people who are given the opportunity will pay for creative content. And I think that the music and television and film industries are way behind the times and they really need to catch up. Ooh, that's a little editorial comment. But I do have some comments to go over today. And I think that I will start first with phone comments. And you know what that means.
My phone! Get off my phone, you little pinhead! Get off my phone! I'm gonna lose my mind today!
We're sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
Hi, Arthur. This is Rebecca, the expat Kiwi living in the US, and I was listening to show number 179 on podcast. I'm afraid I'm a little behind the curve here. And you and the guys were talking about the ways in which gays are characterized as different by homophobes and were commenting on how much focus there is in that differentiation on sex and sexual activity, which is a perfectly sound point, of course. It occurred to me that white racists seeking to differentiate blacks also, in making that difference, have at times been focused on sexual characteristics and sexual activity. And I'm thinking particularly of, say, civil rights era American racist attempts to differentiate blacks. So just sort of thought that was an interesting point, that perhaps this is a more widespread thing in terms of differentiating the other, is to focus on sexual behavior and how the other is somehow different and pretty routinely worse than the norm in terms of sexual behavior. So, a thought for you. Hope you're having a great time. Bye.
Well, thanks, Rebecca. That's actually an interesting point. And I think there was one aspect that's happening even today, which is sort of related to that whole thing. And that was the case of the Justice of the Peace in Louisiana, who refused to marry an interracial couple because they would produce mixed-race children. And I remember during the civil rights era that people talked about mixed-race children, what a problem this was. I'm putting quote marks. You can't see that. And it's sort of amazing to see that that attitude still exists. I know that for some bigots during that era, the idea of, in particular, of mixed-race couples doing it, in quotes, was absolutely disgusting to them, pretty much as disgusting as the idea of two men or two women. So I think that's a very valid point, and it's something that really social scientists and social historians should look at a little more deeply, because it actually might explain a lot of the kind of emotional reaction that we see from the right wing to these sorts of issues. But I now have another phone comment, and it is from Rebecca.
Oh, hi, Arthur. This is Rebecca. I was discussing podcast number 182 about Halloween, among other things, at the dinner table today. And this question came up, which I turn to you for answer. Is it harder to find Halloween-themed merchandise or matzah at Passover in New Zealand? So, because you are now my source for all things about my homeland that I need to know, I'm turning that one over to you. I will be relying on you for the upcoming referenda, too. Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Rebecca. That call just came in today. Fortunately, it's like an anniversary present because it guarantees my phone line now for another month. Woohoo! I'm now secure into December. Isn't that great? But to answer your first question first about the availability of goods, I think it depends on where you live. At least that's my impression. I've posted on my blog a few posts about Halloween and how it seems to be waning in Auckland. But I've heard from some other people in other parts of the country, and they say, oh, no, it's still going strong here. But it does seem that it is moving away from the American model of trick-or-treating and all of that to more party-oriented, whether it's kids' parties or themes at bars and pubs and things like that, whatever. But basically, it's not along the American model. And what that has translated into is that it is harder, in Auckland anyway, to find Halloween-themed things. In my case in particular, I went out looking for things just so I could kind of document whether my test whether my theory was true. And I went to the warehouse at Glenfield Mall, which is not far from where we live, reasonably short drive. And that the warehouse bills it, for the uninitiated, the warehouse is modeled on what the hell is it called? Walmart. God, it's modeled on that, although it's in a Kiwi context, so it's a bit different. But it is, I believe it is New Zealand's largest retailer. I'm pretty damn sure it is. And it's a discount chain, but kind of along the lines of Walmart, as it used to be more than it is now. Anyway, Walmart, the warehouse bills itself as the home of Halloween. And so I went in there, although the circular that came out a week or so before Halloween had about half of a page devoted to Halloween merchandise. And this is out of 16-20 page flyer, whatever it was. So I go into this warehouse, and there was a small section of stuff, and I would say the whole thing from end to end, it was maybe 4 meters, maybe. That's being a bit generous, and by about a meter and a half wide. It wasn't a whole aisle, it wasn't even a whole part of an aisle. And part of that, a good chunk of it, was a rack of pre-made costumes. And there's actually a photo of that on my blog, but also of some decorations and things like that. Now, the warehouse closer to our house had even less than that. It was maybe a meter square, maybe a bit more. And that's it. That was the extent of their Halloween stuff. This was just before Halloween when they're trying to promote the day. Or actually, they're probably trying to clear it out, to be honest, because a day or so ahead of this would have been, I guess, Thursday maybe. And I'd heard a commercial on the radio saying that there was 20% off all Halloween decorations while supplies lasted, which sounded to me like it was a clearance. So it wasn't easy to find the bits and pieces that go into Halloween, not just the costumes, but also the decorations and things like that. And finding candy for potential trick-or-treaters was even harder because grocery stores generally had little or no promotion for Halloween candy. And again, I've got a photo on my blog. And I ended up getting some, but it was from a teeny tiny little display in a grocery store, not the one that I photographed. And by teeny tiny, I mean it was less than a meter square. It was just a cardboard holder for M&M Mars, actually, made in Australia. But certainly wasn't very impressive by my standards. And I found that throughout the areas that I've looked at here in Auckland. Now, in terms of other things, things for Passover have never been easy to find. The grocery store we go to is Countdown, which is an Australian chain, and Australian-owned chain. And it, in its international foods area, used to have Manischewitz line of stuff all the time, year-round. And that might have included matzah and gefilte fish and things like that. But I don't actually know where that is since they've redone the store. That it's probably still there and I just haven't seen it because I haven't been looking for it, I suppose. But there's certainly no promotions of any kind. I've never seen anything promoting anything to do with Passover or any other religious holiday, not even really Easter or Christmas, which are usually promoted as secular holidays to buy things. The Jewish population of New Zealand is about 2%, roughly. which is not all that different from the percentage of New Zealanders who have classified themselves as Lutheran. This is actually old data. I haven't looked this up recently. This could have changed in recent years. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if it has. I should do a podcast just on religion someday. I'll put that in my little to-do cap. Anyway, there isn't that much promotion of anything to do with any particular religion, but there is starting to be a promotion and awareness of more ethnic-related things, like, for instance, Diwali, the Indian festival, Indian. And things like that. And Pacifica, of course, is a huge event in Auckland. I'm actually not sure that these sorts of events are as big in other parts of the country as they are in Auckland, because Auckland is such a melting pot. It's quite ethnically diverse now. So I'm not sure, but certainly there isn't any particular promotion of anything to do with religion, or I should say religious events. Now, as for the referendum, funny you should mention that, because just today, the New Zealand Herald published the results of a poll, and it was a Herald DigiPoll, which is what they call all their polls, and the headline says, "Nearly half say they will vote to ditch MMP," and okay, I'll read what the relevant part it says. The survey shows 49% of respondents said they would vote to get rid of the controversial electoral system when it goes to referendum in 2011. Okay, next paragraph. Only 35.8% of those polled would keep it, and 15.2% said they did not know how they would vote, which potentially means that more than half would vote to keep MMP. Just because they don't know doesn't mean that they're going to be opposed to MMP. So the Herald is jumping the gun a little bit. And when they say that opposition to MMP is stronger than expected, as they also do in the article, that's also jumping to conclusions just a little bit. Because the support for MMP hasn't been measured consistently over the years. And so it's really difficult to say how people's feelings about it have changed. What I can say is that the people who are aligned against it are the same suspects who were against the adoption in the first place, particularly this guy named Peter Shurtcliffe, who used to be the head of Telecom up until 1999, and he also led the opposition to MMP as part of the Business Roundtable, which is a group of conservative businessmen who feel that they should be able to tell New Zealand what to do. Okay, I'm oversimplifying, but that's basically what it is. And I really don't think it's unfair to say that, because they've always had this attitude that they know what's best for all of us. And the Business Roundtable despised the idea of MMP because they felt that they would lose control. And surprise, that's exactly what happened. Because MMP is a proportional representation system, it's increased the level of democracy in New Zealand's parliament. And that has meant that any party which forms government has to do deals with smaller parties, parties that represent specific interests or specific constituencies. And that means that no party can just steamroll through an agenda and do whatever it wants to do come hell or high water, because it needs to have the support of minor parties. It's been a tremendously good thing for New Zealand. It has meant that there's been no opportunity for any prime minister to dictate what will happen and what won't happen. They are always having to do deals with the minor parties. And it keeps things a lot saner here than they otherwise would be. Now, the clear implication in what the Herald is saying is that people don't want proportional representation. Now, they don't say that, but that sure seems to be what they're trying to imply. And there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that New Zealanders want to go back to the failed first-past-the-post system, which is the system America uses, where the person who gets the most votes out of all the candidates wins. So if there's 10 candidates and one candidate gets 20% of the vote, but everybody else got less, then that person wins. Well, no. Under the New Zealand system, the parliament is represent it reflects the percentage of what the people want. Although I don't want to get into that again, how MMP works. It's a subject for another day. I've talked about it before anyway. But the point basically is that there's no evidence to say that New Zealanders want to return to the old-fashioned first-past-the-post system. They may choose a different system, like single transferable vote, which in the U.S. is usually called instant runoff voting. or they may choose something else entirely, or there may be reforms to the MMP system. That's one of the things that John Key has been talking about, not ditching MMP altogether, because he seems to prefer MMP from the comments that he said. What the Prime Minister has said is that there are some tweaks that could be useful in this process. So I would suspect that over the next couple of years, we'll start to see some talk behind, well, not so behind the scenes, some talk about how MMP could be reformed to make it more palatable. And I think what we would be looking at, if that happens, is increasing the threshold of votes that a party would have to get in order to get into Parliament if they don't win an electorate seat, maybe reduce the percentage of Parliament that is elected on the list, although I don't know how you can do that and maintain proportionality, or maybe introduce a proportionality system into the electorates themselves, although the only way I can see to do that is through STV or IRV, whatever you want to call it. But this may end up being a very complicated subject that I may have to do little segments on over time, or it may end up being really easy. At this point, we just don't know. But it's clear that the right is already starting to align itself up in how it wants things to be portrayed and how it wants to frame the debate. But I don't think they're going to be able to control it, to be honest. And I also don't think that we're going to be, you know, going back at all. But I certainly will have a lot more to say about this topic in the future episodes, but probably not so much over the next year, I wouldn't think. Now over to the written comments, and this is for the most recent live chat, which is called it's 183, and it was live chat, What Agenda? And that was essentially looking at this whole idea of a gay agenda and so on. And the first comment about the episode itself was from Roger Green, who said, "First, I have difficulty with the notion that the Black Equality Drive is finished. The conversation early on suggesting that it is merely a historical event rather than an ongoing issue, I find problematic. Also, there is a Black agenda, or more than one. One is defined by Blacks, e.g., and it has a link to nationalblackagendaonline.com. The other is defined by the right, that Blacks want all of the goodies of the liberal agenda, in quotes, such as healthcare, etc. I do agree that there is anti-gay bigotry by some Blacks, though to suggest that that is of the Black community, whatever that means, makes me a bit uneasy. I agree that bigotry by one who's from a discriminated group against another from a discriminated group has never made sense to me." And then he has a second comment where he also provides a link to the number of non-religious in the U.S. has been growing for some time. And that's a very useful link. Now, I replied in writing, and I said, "Not surprisingly, I completely agree with you, Roger, and tried to make a few of the points you raised, as I have before. Oddly, I have a tendency to dominate the conversation on my own show. Imagine that. So sometimes I just keep quiet. Be that as it may, I agree that the struggle for African Americans is far from over. It's far from over for any minority in the U.S., for that matter, which is why I keep trying to get people to stop pitting minorities against each other. I know that, in my case, I was just trying to remember if in the 1960s African Americans were exposed to the same sort of irrational talk of their agenda, but I was probably too young to notice. Of course, there's homophobia in the Black community, just as there's racism in the white gay male community. Personally, I'm less troubled that prejudice exists than that some people seem hell-bent on acting on it, as if it was a legitimate and sensible thing to do. Larkin was talking about examining our beliefs and attitudes on issues, which is certainly good, but I'd add that people should examine their prejudices to try and rise above them. But I still maintain that the problem with homophobia among Blacks and Hispanics has less to do with race or ethnicity than it does with conservative religion, which is also the source of the vile anti-gay hatred we see in attacks on the mythical gay agenda, as a way to stop the real one. After all, no one tries to suggest that far-right white religious folks are against gay people because of our race." And I think that's one, if I could make one point about that whole topic, it would be that it's absurd to say that it's a racial thing that African Americans or Hispanics, when they are against Black people, against gay people, because they don't make that same claim about conservative white religious people. The enemy, if you want to use that word, the opponent, if you prefer, isn't race, ethnicity, or anything like that, class. The opponent is conservative religion. And that is where this homophobia is based. It has very little to do with race, ethnicity, or class, or any of those sorts of things, although it is in some cases related to culture, but again, that is usually related back to conservative religion. Well, that's about it for this 14th anniversary edition. That's my 14th anniversary, our 14th anniversary. This week, Jason and I are going to be recording a Too Political podcast. I'm not quite sure what day yet, but it'll be coming up soon. Also, there will be the usual live Amrens podcast on Pride48.com beginning at 8 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, which is now 2 p.m. Friday New Zealand time. I have to change my starting time, my starting time, because the U.S. has changed their clocks. That's how it works. And I have been considering moving the start time of the show to 9 p.m. Eastern time, because that would make it 8 Central, 7 Mountain, 6 Pacific, which means that there might be more opportunity for other people to take part. If you live in North America and you have a strong feeling about that one way or the other, please do let me know. But as it stands this week, it will start at 8 p.m. Eastern time in North America, which is now 2 p.m. Friday New Zealand time. Don't know what the topic is going to be, but it'll be there. But that's it for today, and I will be back later this week with the Too Political at TooPolitical.com, and of course the live show on Thursday/Friday. Have a great rest of the week, and I'll talk to you later. Bye. You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrens Podcast at AmrensPodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, at AmrensPodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. comment line on 206-666-5172. This podcast is produced and distributed on a Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.